Welcome to the Jazz Legends podcast, which was born out of the Jazz Evensong gatherings on Sunday nights at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. Miles Davis once said all musicians should set aside a day each year to honor Duke Ellington. This year, the Evensong Jazz Quintet has set aside two. Earlier this year, we performed our version of his sacred concert, and this week we offer a sampling of his contributions to the Great American Songbook. It's not hyperbole to state that this man contributed as much to jazz and American music as anyone, living or dead. His legacy as a composer, performer, and bandleader is undeniable. And the knowledgeable jazz musicians you'll hear today on the podcast are...
Gunnar Biggs, bass.
Keith Bishop, saxophone.
Leonard Thompson, piano.
Bob Weller, drums.
Joey Carano, guitar.
And I'm Father Doran Stambaugh, host of the podcast. And we did Duke Ellington's Sacred Music Concert a couple months ago, and now we'll get to hear some other of his compositions coming up on a Sunday. And I'm going to let Leonard kick us off with his thoughts on Duke Ellington, because he wasn't here when we talked about him a few weeks ago at the podcast.
Yeah, I guess my own experience, especially lately, the past maybe 5-10 years, in really appreciating Duke Ellington has been with regards to how he plays piano. It's really refreshing because I think he approaches it, like, first and foremost, maybe with a rhythmic drive in mind. And that's like the pulse that's guiding everything else, which is, I think, a lot of great players do that, including Monk, you know, who there's a direct lineage artistically between him and Duke. But when I first started getting into jazz, I would geek out on the notes, and you want to make the perfect lines and have all the notes be, you know, just as you want them. And that's important too when you're sort of figuring out your material. But when you're sort of performing in real time, I think what's so special about Duke is it's always going forward, and it's sort of guided by this sort of inner drummer, you know. And he's like, I heard Dizzy Gillespie put it one way before someone was talking to him about, you know, how he improvises. And he said, you know, some people, they think of a note and put a rhythm to it. I try to think of a rhythm and put a note to it. So I really feel like that's what Duke does when he plays piano. And I think it's a lot easier maybe to get a good flow happening when you're thinking like that as an improviser, because we can all just sit here and not even think about something and tap out a rhythm, and there's not going to be any overthinking, you know? So if you have that as your base, and then you're sort of layering the notes on top of that with material that's already deep in your brain, then I think it makes like a good experience for both the player and the listener, because you're just, I don't know, it seems organic in some way, and it seems like a good way to tell a musical story, you know. And I think he did that really, really convincingly, aside from all the great, you know, harmonic and pianistic things that he brought into the world as well, you know. And you could talk about those forever too, but that's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately.
Do you think that rhythmic thing that he had came from his direct lineage to the stride players that preceded him?
I mean, it must.
Because he and Monk were two of the guys that actually came out of that tradition more so than some other piano players that
influenced
everybody.
Sure.
That's interesting. You both would mention the Duke-Monk thing.
Yeah.
Because there's a story about sometime when the first time that Duke heard Monk, they said, "What do you think?" He says, "He's stealing my shit." That was his first comment when he heard Monk for the first time. And I didn't really put those two together till I heard Money Jungle.
Yeah.
That album with Max Roach and Charlie Mingus, trio album.
Yeah.
Plays completely different than he did from the big band.
Yeah.
Because he was more directorship with the big band. I think that's where that rhythmic direction comes. You guys are hearing the time, you know?
Yeah.
But with those two guys with him, he was just playing like Monk. And I'm thinking, he sounds like Monk, you know, and
exactly.
He thought, Monk sounds like me, you know.
Yeah, so. He was doing that.
Yeah.
He was doing that, but way back when.
Way back.
You're making me think a couple things. One, hearing you describe a rhythmic solo makes me think of when you guys trade with drums and how, I mean, I'm looking at you, Joey, and you, Leonard, Well, because a lot of times you guys will, I know you do, the sax does too, but when I hear the drums do a little something, I almost, I'm hearing a melody, but then you guys will respond and I'm hearing a percussive thing. Like it really blends when you guys trade that way with, was that what you call it, trade?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's almost hear the melody in the different drums and cymbals, but
yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, and I think that's why moments like that tend to go well, because we're just thinking rhythmically. You know, if we're interacting in a light way like that, or just listening to one another's rhythmic ideas, then there's a lot of space in the air cleared. You know.
Yeah. You know. Well, and sometimes even it's like Bob, you play a line or whatever, and then you pop something out on the guitar and all of a sudden you're like amplifying, or I don't know if it's subconscious or what, but it's like, no, there was a little bit of a melody in there, because even the drums have slightly different tones, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get some melodic color coming out of them.
Well, and obviously Bob and he's playing something, their rhythmic ideas that maybe aren't on the surface of my vocabulary, maybe not there at all. And so it's fun to go there, and it's a cute little communicative thing. And also, I think maybe when we're in a band and we're sending a message to one another, hey, I'm listening to you, and we're joking around a little bit, and that hopefully will snowball into even more communication and then development as a band, you know, and all the little inner workings of a band, and it, coming out at the end with maybe a unique sound as a band, you know, being inclusive of one another.
Yeah. I know playing with a drummer and playing without a drummer are like two completely different worlds for me. When I have to go out on a gig that's just like with a chordal instrument or just bass and chordal instrument, it's not nearly as inspiring as having a drummer that's feeding me these different ideas, essentially.
Well, you know, it's not just that, but it's the focus, too. When you have like all those hard sounds, you know, all the sharp sounds in the drums, they tend to get the rhythmic thing more focused, you know. And if you really, like, I'm always thinking about that when I'm playing, you know, trying to get things focused so that it's comfortable to play. You know, so that when you play an eighth note, you know exactly where you want to put it. It feels right. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
So and if you're playing with a lousy drummer, it's the opposite.
It's the worst. Yeah,
it's like, horrible. Now what do I do? Yeah. Nothing fits.
You can't get anything going. You can't get anything going.
And I think you, Bob, as a fine pianist, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, we hear you're thinking harmonically and melodically as well as, you know, just striking your forehead against a wall or something. Yeah. You know, it's because you can really tell drummers that know music and not just percussion because it comes out, you actually, and you're right, Doran, the melodic thing can be heard on drums as well.
Well, and you're making me think now, when if I think about listening to you play piano on some of your runs, they remind me of some of your fills, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, rhythmically, I suppose. Yeah.
I kind of oftentimes I wonder what my left hand is doing, whether it's playing chords or snare drum. I can't tell. I can't tell what it's doing.
Yeah.
It's a mind of its own, I think.
I thought it was rototoms.
Haven't you done that, too? I'm told. I don't think I've seen you do it, where you got piano on one part of your body and
left hand
drum on another.
I've done a couple gigs with him where he's playing right cymbal and comping with his left hand on a little keyboard.
I can either comp on the keyboard or I can play bass on the keyboard. Either one. I use the left hand. Cool. Yeah. Yeah, that's been fun.
I think you were doing it more to show off.
Yeah. No,
I was impressed. Anyhow.
It's pretty impressive.
We had a trio with that time we were playing with Dean.
Over
we had a trio, and it was bass and Keith and me, and no chords. So I figured, well, I'll just put the keyboard up on my snare drum and play the chords. And it was nice for the slow stuff.
It was nice. Yeah. It was nice for everything.
Yeah.
Then you can, with your other foot that's not doing anything, you can tune the piano.
Well, how are you going to paint it? You're going to be Joni style. Yeah, right. Sorry, Joni. I'll brush it. Remember her?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's another. This is a question that's pretty basic and academic. But what is the difference between, you guys are talking about stride. What's the difference between ragtime and stride? Maybe I may have asked that before. But didn't it develop? Didn't ragtime come first and then the stride thing? And it's one is an outgrowth of the other, right?
Yeah, I think it's chronological mostly because they're both a solo piano situation and they both are very two-handed and orchestral. But I think stride coming a little bit after Ragtime started to incorporate different tunes and started to incorporate improvisation a little bit more. And, you know, and the vocabulary got a little bit different in the eighth note feel, I think, got a little bit different too. Not to get too crude about definitions of swing, but it might have started to swing a little bit in a different way than Ragtime. Although that's a whole other conversation because, you know, that period in the 70s when the Sting and all that came back to repopularize Ragtime, I think a lot of people were playing the eighth notes very, very straight, and that might have been incorrect. And I think a lot of more knowledgeable accounts of what Ragtime sounded like way back when say that there was, you know, an actual swing kind of element to the eighth notes, that kind of thing.
If you listen to Leonard play with the group on Sundays, you're not going to hear him playing any stride. I mean, hardly ever, maybe once in a while. That's because we have a bass player who's playing in four a lot of the time. And, you know, the stride thing is basically in cut time or 2-4 or 4-4 cut time. And so it's going to conflict with the bass. And, you know, so we don't generally play that way anymore in a group. But solo piano, you know, you could definitely do it.
Is that what stride was, also getting a bass line?
Well, you're playing the bass line, then playing a chord in your left hand, like a boom, chick, boom, chick.
Gotcha. Stride. That's the stride.
That's the stride.
Okay. Yeah. And so we don't do that in a group now because it would conflict with what the bass is doing and what the drums are doing.
So it was never for a group. It was more solo.
You can do it, but as long as everybody knows that, you know, you're playing in two and you're not going to be playing in four. You know, so
I think Duke might have changed his voicing thing too with Max Roach and Charles Mingus too, because he had a bass player, and Max was the ideal propulsion unit for Duke too. So he didn't have to keep that thing going. He plays different voicings. To my ear,
I know you're aware of the story where Mingus ran out because he thought that Duke, with his left hand, was insulting him
on that date for Money Jungle.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't heard that story.
I think it was that date, but that's the only trio record I think that they made.
Yeah.
But Duke ran, you know, followed him and said, "Hey, no, it's just the way I play. I'm heavy with the left hand."
Because Mingus hit him in the face. Pulled a knife on Mingus, but he didn't use it.
He had a chainsaw that day. You know.
That's so fascinating for me to hear that because, as a listener, I mean, you never know how they were feeling or what they were thinking. And
that's right.
I was listening to Money Jungle yesterday, and it was like the most amazing thing I've ever heard. And I haven't spent a lot of time with that record, but I'm just sitting there, this is like taking acid or something. It's like the most creative stuff I've ever heard, and like the way Mingus is accompanying, you know, he's just all up and down the bass and playing these like textures and not even necessarily playing like, you know, notes or quarter notes in them.
I had to read the record jacket or the CD jacket a few times. Really? Duke? Max and Charles.
Oh, and it's such a perfect marriage.
I've got to hear this, you know.
It's just a trio. Yeah. And they create a world of sonic space. It's just totally amazing. And now that you mention that, I'm looking at the cover, and Mingus, well, I guess often he did look this way, but he looked not like a happy camper.
Well, they made up.
There's something new.
It was a miscommunication thing, I think, but they made friends. But
I had to think, that's so interesting to hear that account because, you know, as I was listening to this, I was just thinking, man, Mingus has really got to be digging this whole thing because it's so, you know, cacophonous and forward motion and gritty and the way everyone's sounding together. I had to figure Mingus must have been having a ball with that, but apparently not, you know.
But it's so far away from Mood Indigo.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing, it could be aliens playing, you know.
And some stride, and I guess it would be considered stride, and I'm sorry, I'm spacing on his name, the piano player that played in the trio with Benny Goodman.
Teddy Wilson.
Yeah. And
I was going to mention that that group that was famously no bass.
Yeah, right.
So he had all the space he wanted.
And Teddy Wilson sounded so beautiful, I think. And there also is a trio record with Lester Young and Teddy Wilson without bass. And in fact, I have a record that is Nat Cole and Lester Young without bass.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot and of Nat people don't remember what a phenomenal pianist Nat Cole was.
Well, and he was doing this with the left hand, motioning left and right, you know, but he also would break it up and then sometimes just go off and play a linear thing, harmonized and go back. You probably influenced Harold.
When
things.
I hung out with Harold Mayburn a couple years ago, he had nothing but big praise for Nat Cole, and he said that like it's so such a drag that so many people don't remember what a fantastic pianist he was. Yeah. He influenced so many players, and it's like almost like forgotten these days.
Wrapping up here, do you guys want to? We'll go around real fast, lightning round. Your favorite Duke Ellington tune and why?
Oh, God.
Is that even possible?
I don't know if this would be my absolute favorite, but one that I never fail to enjoy playing and that I have to keep reminding myself it's in D flat, apparently not C, which will be a lot more fun to play it in that key sometimes because we often all play it in C, but Prelude to a Kiss, which is a great, usually play it as a ballad, but it has a lot of harmonic material in it and goes through a lot of different keys and has just a beautiful melody. So there's a lot of meat in that tune.
I like that one too.
I was going to think a ballad up tune, you know, because there's so many stages when he was a dance band at the Apollo, then when it went concert, and then when he played in the tree. I think some of the, I can't come up with some of the titles, but some of the stuff off Money Jungle.
Yeah.
It was just such an eye opener and a head blower that I would say several of them on Money Jungle.
What's that rhythm changes head that he wrote?
Cottontail.
That's awesome little tweaky little something.
The dance tunes were so danceable, but they were also really good to blow on.
Yeah.
You know?
And the big band arrangement of Cottontail with the saxophone solo is still a classic. Yeah. It's like he wrote so much great music for his band.
But then there are the songs that still are coming up all the time, Don't Get Around Much Anymore, Satin Doll, you know, these are songs that are still played at weddings.
His ballads were just phenomenal.
I would say
Sophisticated
ballads.
Lady. And,
Sophisticated Lady, sure.
In a Sentimental Mood and Solitude.
Yeah.
It's like phenomenal, some of the music that he wrote. It's going to live forever.
The Evensong Quintet will feature the music of Duke Ellington on May 5th, starting at 4 p.m. The weekly Jazz Evensong gatherings are free and open to the public, and take place Sundays at 4 p.m. at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. See you there.